Today's Science Questions presents this one-hour special on adolescent addiction and recovery. This three-part series profiles recovery schools that are gaining praise and support across the nation. These unique programs cater to youth who suffer from serious addictions and who have either been kicked out of their traditional schools or just did not fit in. Recovery schools offer sobriety and the tools to build a successful future.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery. This is part one in our series called Adolescent Recovery. It takes a community.
There is a substance abuse epidemic in the United States. All drug abuse issues combined cost the U.S. public health system $500 billion a year, and it kills 500,000 people every year. Drug abuse is the most costly public health problem. Teenagers are especially vulnerable, and teenage substance abuse disorders are on the rise. Just over 2 million youth in the U.S., ages 12 to 17, have a substance use disorder, meaning dependence on or abuse of alcohol or drugs. And each year, fewer than 1% of these young teenagers get the treatment they need. In the last decade, there has been more focus on treatment programs, though post-treatment programs are not nearly as emphasized. And teenagers coming out of rehabilitation have nowhere safe to go. According to the Journal of Groups in Addiction and Recovery, for teenagers, school often sits at the heart of the relapse threat. One study found that virtually all adolescents returning to their old school reported being offered drugs on their first day back. In fact, the leading reasons for adolescents' recidivism is returning to the environment of previous use. Some of our nation's leaders see the importance of addressing this problem immediately, and Massachusetts State Senator Stephen Tolman is not waiting for Superman. Before being elected to the Senate in 1998, Senator Tolman worked in the railroad industry and was a union representative, where he witnessed and confronted coworkers who were addicted to painkillers.
It seems when somebody gets sick, when somebody gets addicted, when they get hooked on alcohol or pills, the first thing people want to do is pretend there isn't a problem.
But there is a problem, and Senator Tolman realized the extent of it across the state of Massachusetts. Now he works with an effective team of advocates, doctors, teachers, politicians, parents, and Massachusetts is now leading the national surge in recovery schools. There are voluntary, safe, and sober public schools for students recovering from addiction to continue their education.
The reality is that around the late 90s and the early 2000s, I started to see firsthand the devastating effects that OxyContin was having on our communities. And I'm in my 50s now, and, you know, I tried different things growing up. As you grow up, you try different things, you know, and you sort out life when you're trying to find your way. Well, these children were doing something very similar, but what they did is they snorted this OxyContin, and almost like it owned them, it grabbed their brain. In fact, between 2002 and 2007, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we lost 78 soldiers in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And during that same five-year period in the streets of Massachusetts, we buried 3,265 citizens to the category of poisonous overdoses, which is primarily OxyContin and heroin. And one has to ask, who bears that responsibility? And why can't we get it under control?
In recent years, adolescent alcohol and drug use has garnered more attention, carving a much-needed place in discussions of healthcare reform and education. And recovery schools are a product of this movement. 18-year-old Brandon is a recent graduate from Safe Recovery School in Springfield, Massachusetts. He started smoking cigarettes when he was 10 years old, and that was just the beginning.
After doing marijuana for probably about a year and a half from the time I was 12, I decided I want to try something else. So I started drinking, and then I love drinking. And to be honest, I still love it. I don't want to drink, but I mean, it feels good. Same thing with drugs, they feel good.
They're interested in the here and now, How will this make me feel now?
Glenn Hansen is the director of the Utah Addiction Center and professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Utah. He is an expert on how addiction affects the brain and behavior.
They don't ask the question, well, how am I going to feel in 10 years? Or what is this going to do to me when I'm 40 years old? Will I be fighting brain cancer or cardiovascular disease because of this? That's way, way too far out of their scope of appreciation. So they're right about, oh, does this really get me excited and stoked within a minute or in a few minutes? And that's very appealing to them. So they're a highly vulnerable population to addiction problems.
Andy Finch is assistant professor in the College of Education and Human Development at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and once a recovery school teacher. He is now the co-founder of the Association of Recovery Schools.
If you understand what goes into a person abusing alcohol and drugs, you would clearly understand it's not a moral failing, that there are so many different elements that go into a child who is 14, 15, and probably was abusing far younger, oftentimes 11, 12, to say that, oh, they're just making a bad choice. There are family elements, there are genetic elements, there are environmental elements, economic elements. There's an awful lot of things, mental health elements. To just say that this kid wants to party too hard and they need to make a different choice is being completely ignorant of what we know about alcohol and drug abuse. And I'll tell you, most of us that have been in the field have known that the science is now catching up and proving it.
This is your basic structural scan that you'll get, even a clinical read. It looks at the structural anatomy of the tissues. The next one that we're going to do...
Dr. Melissa Lopez-Larson is using the MRI, powerful magnetic resonance imaging technology, to look closely at brain tissue. She is a child psychiatrist and part of a USTAR, Utah Science Technology and Research Initiative team at the University of Utah, conducting clinical studies on the effects of marijuana on the adolescent brain.
Preliminary research suggests that using substances before the age of 16 can really hamper your brain development and cause a lot of kind of neurocognitive consequences long term. So in general, adolescence is a time of robust kind of brain changes, and you have increased emotional development, increased cognitive development, and increase ability to attend to goals and to increase ability to make appropriate decisions. And so if you're impacting your brain by giving it substances during those key periods of time, you know, we're pretty convinced that you're really going to impact how the brain is going to wire itself.
Lopez acknowledges to really understand the impact of marijuana on the brain, they need to continue monitoring the cognitive functioning of these adolescent brains into adulthood to see if, once they quit using, their brains catch up to functioning at the level of an individual who never used. Dr. Glenn Hansen.
And the traditional development in an adolescent is that those areas that are important for decision making do not get fully matured until the mid-20s. So they continue this high degree of impulsivity until they get into that later stage, that 20, 25 years of age. And if you can keep them away from the drugs until then the chances they'll get into trouble with the drugs goes down dramatically. It's kind of going back to the smoking piece. If you start smoking before you're the age 13, trying to stop smoking as an adult, you've got about 3-4% success rate. That means 95-96% will not succeed. If you start smoking after you're an adult, the success rate is about 95%. So there's a big difference when you start, the effect it's had on your brain and trying to stop on the other end, that tells you that there have been some developmental changes that have occurred because of the presence of the drug. We can say the same thing about alcohol. We can say the same thing about methamphetamine. We can say the same thing even about marijuana. The earlier you start exposing your brain to this chemistry, the greater the likelihood it's going to change the way development occurs and affect your decision-making later on relative to that drug and relative to other things as well.
Before attending Safe Recovery High, Brandon spiraled into a typical pattern of drug use.
After drinking, I got into the heavier stuff. I started doing cocaine, and then I got into heroin, first snorting it and then shooting it. And that's when it really hit me, that, because I always thought, oh, I'll never do that. Even if I just smoke a little bit of weed or something, then I'm never going to do heroin. I'm never going to do any of the hard drugs. But it finally hit me, and before I knew it, I was stealing money from my mom and dad, stealing on an average a couple $100 a week when I was 14 or 15.
How are you stealing it?
I was just walking into my mom's room, stealing, grabbing her purse and just grabbing all the money I could get. Then they figured out that I was stealing from them, and they said something to me, and I denied it. They knew I stole it. I knew they knew. I just still denied it. I just didn't want to accept what I was doing.
By 15, Brandon ended up hustling drugs and in a violent gang.
Or once you're down with a gang or whatever, you can't get out.
Why did you stop hanging out with them?
I got a reality check when I almost had to kill somebody. And everybody was saying, pull the trigger, man, da da da. And I couldn't do it. So I realized, this is bad, I can't do this anymore. So I dropped the gun and I walked away, grabbed the bus and I went home.
In his freshman year, he transferred to a vocational school. But that didn't work either. Nothing seemed to work.
I was in a machine shop and I started making a lot of bowls, like for smoking and stuff, a lot of paraphernalia. And I got caught doing that, and I got caught with drugs, got caught selling them, buying them, using them, all that stuff. And they asked me to leave, otherwise they were gonna pretty much have me get arrested. So I left after my freshman year. And then my sophomore year, I was at my hometown school, Munson High, except I only lasted 3 days before getting suspended, and then I got hospitalized after an incident that happened at my house.
We might live like never before. There's nothing to give. Well, how can we ask for more?
After running away from home, an overdose, and multiple treatment programs, Brandon found a school that accepted him as a recovering addict.
And then I came to Recovery High my sophomore year. Like, I didn't think it was possible, but people had worse experiences. They shared their life stories, and we were all just really comfortable with each other.
So I just feel my sorrow with the words you borrow from the only place that you've known.
Brandon entered the Safe Recovery High School in Springfield, Massachusetts. Recovery schools are public schools with highly structured programs and extra support staff like police officers, drug counselors, and staff who administer regular drug testing. One of the most successful schools in the nation is North Shore Recovery High School in Beverly, Massachusetts, run by Michelle Opinski, a charismatic principal. She's also an avid lobbyer and advocate for publicly supported recovery. She is really approachable and popular, and so when I finally cornered her for an interview, we had to slip away from an entourage of students and colleagues. Even then, her phone was still going off with a stream of incoming text messages from her students.
When I started this high school, I thought everybody wanted to come in and be sober and yay, sing kumbaya and get all better. And as I've turned to find out, addiction just in adolescence typically doesn't look like that, where students get better and then that's it, and then they're better for the rest of their lives. There's slips and falls, and we need to be there for them and kind of root them through that and figure out what they need.
Lipinski says that not only do they listen to students and try to meet quite individualized needs, but previous students are a powerful tool in motivating the newer recovery students.
You do drug testing. I have mandatory urine screens. So try to get 56 kids urine screened in 2 hours. And we're talking observed screens, you know, somebody going in there, a third party going in there with them, watching them screen, signing it, doing it, okay, trying to find all 56 and make sure they're screened in 2 hours. Takes an army, a cadre, if you will, of graduates who have gone through that and kind of know how they were like, oh, I had to do it, so you got to do it kind of thing. When I put my licensed social worker out there, they don't listen to them. So just you keep tweaking it based on what you see students react to, I guess.
Education views and policies on substance abuse and mental health typically are that students will eventually be kicked out or will drop out. Before starting a recovery school, Lipinski taught biology at a standard public high school where she noticed a major problem.
I guess maybe I saw that the dynamic in education was changing and a lot more students were needing a lot more social-emotional support. I had 120 students at the beginning of the school year, so, you know, 20, 30 kids per class and all varying levels. And I remember really distinctly at the beginning going, oh my goodness, 100 papers, 100 lab reports, 100 everything, that's a lot, like that's a lot, right? So, and then at the end of it, I only had 82. Like I lost almost 40 students that year. And then you just see like the whole back row of your class not there anymore or not doing anything, or I call them in-school dropouts. They come into school, they get high, they fall asleep. And you look down and you see pot mushrooms and pot plants and everything on top of their papers, and they're drawn and they're like sketching. And they're telling me, hey, look at me, I'm doing mushrooms and smoking weed and I'm sleeping in a class and I'm failing. And I was like, well, at least he's here. Like nobody taught me what to do.
Many teachers are in her position, over 30 students in a classroom, and they just can't get to all the students. She decided to do something about it.
Went back to school and got my ed leadership degree, and I was working, and I realized that I needed to start an alternative school through just a series of, you know, fortunate, unfortunate, whatever you may call them, events. And I started this alternative school, much to the dismay of my building principal and my superintendent, who said, no, you're going to hate it. I'm like, why would you want to do that? Those are for those bad kids. But I'd realized by this point in time, those were the students I wanted to teach. But you're such a qualified person. And I said, yes, and that's why they deserve to have a qualified teacher. And so I started the Salem High Alternative Program back in 1999.
She started an alternative school first, which was a stepping stone to her building a recovery school later that would deal strictly with substance abuse and mental illness.
And lo and behold, 2001 hit with the onslaught of OxyContin in our area, and other prescription drugs hit hard, really, really hard. And I started seeing kids coming in and doing things I hadn't seen before, which was kind of nodding off, falling asleep, kind of just not present, eyes pinned. But I still don't know what that was. And nobody in my graduate classes said, oh, this is what little Johnny's going to look like when he's, you know, smoking crack or when he's shooting heroin or snorting pills. So I didn't know. And I thought, well, at least they're coming to school. So I did night rides with probation officers on Thursday nights, and we would see these kids, and they'd be in their element, and it'd be kind of fun, you know, and you just kind of harass them. But you have that, you know, funny interaction with them anyway, because you're not just that teacher. And then I started losing kids to addiction, and whether they stopped coming to school, and then I would read about them in the paper, and it just says, like, accidental death. Not too many people were really stated as an overdose. So I would say accidental death, and of course, we all knew what was happening. And so 2003, 2004, really same thing was kind of happening. And I kept telling my superintendent, hey, just so you know, we kind of have a problem here.
The superintendent did listen. His own son had a heroin addiction and a recovery school was opening. He wanted Lipinski to lead it. While nursing a baby, she found herself applying and accepting a job as the principal of the North Shore Recovery School in Beverly, Massachusetts, feeling her way through the dark.
I'm really not taking it seriously. I'm like, yeah, recovery school, what is that? They're like, well, we don't know yet. I'm like, all right, well, this is a challenge already to start a school that nobody knows what the hell they're doing in Massachusetts. Do we have a model? Yeah, no. Do we have a student? Nope. Do you have a building? Nope. Teachers? No. Curriculum? No. Do I have a phone? No. Do I have a computer? No. We'll give you a laptop, though. That, I had a laptop. And I got to sit underneath the superintendent's office and steal it for about the first 4 months.
Laptop in hand, she began to build the school, starting with strategically recruiting good teachers.
And then I said, you know, how much do you make? And she told me, I go, I can beat that by $15,000. And she was like, oh, are you still at the alternative school? And I was like, well, no. I'm actually starting this new school. And she goes, well, who are we teaching? I go, Dina. We have Dina. This is who we're teaching so far. But I could still pay you this money, and all we have to do is teach Dina so far. And we get to develop curriculum for Dina.
Since then, the school has grown to around 60 students with a staff of 11 teachers. And their philosophy is simple.
And really what I've learned is just it's humor, chocolate, and relentlessly making fun of the students. And that works because they have a good sense of humor.
But it's not just humor and chocolate.
I go to the emergency rooms, whatever. Kids have puked on me and then they've told me to F off. And at the end of the day, they come back and they're better. They hug me and they make amends and they get up and they're better. So that's why I do what I do.
There are more deaths from the misuse of prescription pain medications than cocaine or heroin in the U.S. Utah is fourth in the nation for non-medical use of painkillers. Dr. Lynn Webster.
I'm medical director of LifeTree Clinical Research and Pain Clinic in Salt Lake City.
He sees high-risk patients with chronic pain, substance abuse problems, usually with opioids, and often mental illnesses. Opioids suppress pain and can often lead to a feeling of euphoria. Dr. Webster specializes in developing guidelines for physicians to better administer and monitor prescription pain medications.
If we learn about this, if we can understand how we may be contributing to that problem, then maybe we can help solve the problem.
For one of his presentations on the abuse of pain medications, Lipinski and her students took part and presented on recovery schools.
I felt that if we could create an educational system like Michelle and take the kids who have gotten into trouble and place them in a different educational environment, we may give them a chance to live and have a productive life. And so I've been thinking that we need such a community here in Utah, and I think we can have a big impact not only on the lives of individuals, but also on the cost of healthcare in our community.
There are dozens of auxiliary costs from substance abuse that add up to billions of dollars nationally and millions of dollars in the state of Utah alone. Costs for incarceration, lost wages, rehab, and costs associated with the treatment of other medical problems stemming from the illicit use of pain medications. And we all pay for the diverted pharmaceuticals. Drugs that are stolen or sold for illicit purposes. Then there are about 13,000 to 15,000 unintentional overdose deaths annually in the U.S. from prescription medications. In Utah, about 450 each year. The average cost of substance abuse in Utah is $17,000 per person. That is just for medical care, not including treatment programs, compared to an average cost of $4,000 per person without the disease of addiction.
These are human beings. These are good human beings that have just made some bad choices. And because of their genetics and because of the environment and or environment, they get into trouble. Just like a lot of us get into trouble, particularly if we overeat and we have diabetes or heart disease. It's a medical condition.
In fact, scientists such as Glenn Hansen at the University of Utah refer to a new science of addiction. They are studying how genetics influence changes in the brain that result in a compulsive desire to use a drug.
The genetic piece of addiction is about vulnerability. It's not about inevitability, and so that's always something you need to clarify up front. And from what we can tell, it looks like the genetic part or the heritability part is responsible for anywhere from 40 to 60% of addiction vulnerability. And they've identified somewhere close to 100 different genes that might be associated with various pieces of addiction, anywhere from they're more inclined to start using the drug, or they're more interested in one drug over another. Some of it may have to do with self-medicating various pieces of psychiatric disorders, things like ADHD. They have a higher incidence of abuse. People that have mood disorders, depression, or bipolar or schizophrenics, they have higher incidence of drug abuse, and those are genetically linked. So that may be why there's this genetic component to it. Another part may be how difficult is it to get off of a drug once you become addicted, and that may be dictated by genetics as well. Impulsivity, people that have a high degree of impulsivity have a much harder problem with addiction. So if you're in a group where the peer pressure is exerted, adolescents are very susceptible to peer pressure.
And typically, when a student submits to this peer pressure, our society reacts by treating them as criminals. Barbara Frey is a psychologist in Utah who early on in her career recognized the need for more compassion and a better overall understanding of adolescent mental health and drug treatment services.
And by the time you finally notice, the kid's in trouble. The kid's in jail. The kid's in front of the principal looking at expulsion. So we're missing the symptoms. And we know there's data showing that the earlier we get care, these kids enter treatment in their disease, the earlier they learn how to manage it. And as soon as they learn how to manage it, the more productive and the better quality of life they're going to have. And so this is about improving their quality of life, which improves their family's quality of life, which improves the quality of life for our society, because then they're contributing rather than needing to take advantage of a lot of services in society. So rather than waiting till they're in jail, if we can get to them early, before there's so much pain that's caused in their life and in their family's lives and their friends' lives and in the community, then we've made a good investment.
Recovery schools are not the cure-all, but they are often the last resort for students who are trying to overcome addiction in a world where drugs are readily available and where illicit drug use persists at a daunting and dangerous rate. These recovery schools are providing a much-needed service and saving lives. Massachusetts State Senator Steve Tolman.
It's the best bang for the buck. If you turn one person around or save one life, you can't put a dollar sign on that. In these schools, we started with $750,000, and then it was $500,000, $500,000 after that every year. And then we had cooperation from the unions. Everything worked together. It's not a big cost. In fact, really, it's foolish not to have this concept up, because that's the thing, is you just got to push forward and establish it. It's like what they say about the stadium, build it and they will come, build it and they will come.
Luckily, one of them was there for Brandon.
I just live my life, and whatever comes, comes, and whatever happens, happens, but everything happens for a reason, and I think that the whole gang involvement and all the heavy usage of drugs was a purpose for me, because that brought me to recovery school and that changed my life.
Brandon got sober and found a good mentor at the recovery school who introduced him to scuba diving.
As soon as I got in that pool that first time, I loved it. Yep. And I've loved it ever since.
He got his advanced diving certification and his father turned him on to underwater welding. And now Brandon wants to attend a school in New Jersey to pursue his career.
I love welding. I love diving. I love swimming. I love it all.
Oh, gotta see, gotta know right now. What's that writing on your everything?
And that concludes part one of our series, Adolescent Recovery, It Takes a Community.
Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn
and Susie Montgomery.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab and field in outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the tumultuous love affair between former Utah Senator Arthur Brown and his mistress, Ann Bradley. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
In the 21st century, we consider political scandals and courtroom drama to be characteristic of modern times. But 100 years ago, things weren't all that different.
In December 1906, Utah woman Ann Bradley sat alone in a Washington, D.C. jail cell. Her crime? The fatal shooting of her long-term lover, former Utah Senator Arthur Brown. Ann Bradley was a prominent young woman, active in groups like the Salt Lake City Woman's Club and the Utah Woman's Press Club. She met Arthur Brown in 1892 through her work with the Utah Republican Party. The two began a lengthy love affair that went public when Brown was elected in 1896 as one of Utah's first two senators after statehood. Ann Bradley had two sons with Arthur Brown and expected him to marry her as soon as he divorced his wife. Bradley had a long wait for a divorce that never came. Then, in 1905, Brown's wife died, leaving him free to marry Bradley. Still, nothing happened. Repeated delays prompted Bradley to follow Arthur Brown to Washington, D.C. in 1906, where she found evidence that Brown was having another affair with Annie Adams, mother of famous Utah actress Maud Adams. Bradley confronted Brown in his hotel room and, in a fit of rage, shot him point blank. Brown was taken to the hospital, where he later died. Salt Lakers were shocked, but not surprised, by Bradley's crime of passion. At her murder trial, Bradley pleaded emotional insanity, and public sympathy swayed in her favor when it was discovered that Brown had written Bradley and their two sons out of his will. Ann Bradley was acquitted in Washington, D.C., and returned to Utah. She opened an antique shop in Salt Lake City that she operated until her death in 1950. On her death certificate, she is listed as a widow, her deceased husband, Arthur Brown. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Heidi Orchard. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions also comes from Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
This is Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
Americans have an unwavering appetite for drugs. Roughly 12 million Americans, ages 12 and up, use illegal drugs on a regular basis. Dr. Glenn Hansen is director of the Utah Addiction Center.
Well, the United States likes everything. I mean, we do cocaine, we do heroin, we do methamphetamine, we do ecstasy.
The escalating violence in Mexico is evidence of the drug problem in the United States, where most of the drugs end up. Drug abuse issues harm families, the economy, the education and healthcare systems. Each year, all substance abuse issues combined cost the U.S. $500 billion and kills 500,000 Americans.
That's by far the most costly public health problem that we have. That's much greater than cancer, it's much greater than cardiovascular disease, and it just sort of stays there.
In the past, most drug overdoses were due to illegal narcotics. Prescription painkillers have now surpassed heroin and cocaine as the leading cause of fatal overdoses. The number of overdose deaths from opioid painkillers, opium-like drugs that include morphine, codeine, and OxyContin, more than tripled from 1999 to 2006 to 13,800 deaths that year, according to Centers for Disease Control statistics. Teenagers are especially vulnerable, and teenage substance abuse disorders are on the rise. Just over 2 million youth in the United States, ages 12 to 17, have a substance use disorder, meaning dependence on or abuse of alcohol or drugs. In 2008, the number of individuals aged 12 or older who abused prescription pain relievers for the first time was roughly even with the number of marijuana users. Prescription drug use is especially popular in Utah.
As far as prescription abuse, we're up in the top 10%. And the reason is that our culture, while it tends to be very much against illegal substances and it's very much against abusing nicotine and alcohol, prescription drugs have a good housekeeping seal of approval that goes along with them.
Ethan is a recent graduate from Valley High School in Salt Lake City. When he was 15, his younger brother passed away from leukemia, and the tragedy sent Ethan into a downward spiral. He was administered antidepressants and felt those only made his depression worse. After that, he started using illicit drugs and prescription painkillers. It was easy access.
Whatever you think about Salt Lake City, drugs are so readily available here. It's surprisingly rich suburban white bread kids. And seriously, there are kids all over this place with pockets full of ecstasy, pot, you know, coke, whatever. You can get whatever you want here. And it was not hard at all. It took me like one phone call to get whatever I wanted.
Prescription drugs at all?
Yes. Those are actually surprisingly more easy to come by in this state because we look so down on like drinking and other forms of medication. You know, everybody's on prescription painkillers or some sort of prescription. So there's a lot of this taking from my parents. There's this one, he's pretty rich, I would say, huge mansion house up on the bench. And his parents were on tons and tons of, and they had painkillers all the time, and this kid would just give them to me.
Dr. Scott Putman is a urologist at Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City. Much of his job involves managing pain and prescribing drugs that are in high demand for illicit use.
They don't have the stigma attached to them that, say, heroin does. You know, we've heard about all the Mexican cartels and the drug war down in Mexico, and, you know, 26,000 people have been killed in 10 years, and if you're using heroin, you know, if you're part of this. Also, you have to go somewhere to get it, and it could be shady or dangerous, and the people are shady and dangerous. Pain medicines or prescription drugs, oh, they came from Dr. Putman, and then they were sold through the market there, and they're legal for proper use, so what's so bad about just taking it every once in a while? So, you know, these things were pharmaceutically designed to control pain, and they're super strong and super addictive.
Scientific research indicates addiction is a disease that affects both brain and behavior. Many of the biological and environmental factors have been identified, and now genetic variations that contribute to the disease are in pursuit by researchers such as Dr. Glenn Hansen at the University of Utah.
And from what we can tell, it looks like the genetic part or the heritability part is responsible for anywhere from 40 to 60%. Of addiction vulnerability.
Drugs are chemicals. They tap into the brain's communication system, interfering with the way nerve cells normally send, receive, and process information. Some drugs, such as marijuana and opioids, can activate neurons because their chemical structure mimics a natural neurotransmitter. This similarity in structure tricks receptors and allows the drugs to lock onto and activate the nerve cells. Marijuana and other narcotics target the brain's reward system by flooding it with dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter present in regions of the brain that regulate movement, emotion, cognition, motivation, and feelings of pleasure. The overstimulation of this system produces the euphoric effect sought by drug abusers and results in the repeated behavior. That potential of addiction presents a challenge for doctors when prescribing pain medications.
Dr. Lynn Webster has a private practice where he sees high-risk patients with chronic pain.
It's hard to imagine what it's like to live with severe pain. It's really hard for people who are not experiencing pain to know what impact this has on every aspect of their life. And so docs, family members, law enforcement, all have to understand that people who sometimes overuse their medicine are just trying to escape pain. Now, sometimes the pain is not just physical. Sometimes it is the anguish. It is the depression. It is an attempt to find an oasis of relief. Unrelenting pain is cruel.
So Dr. Webster tries to alleviate the pain with a cocktail of pain meds.
The most common pain medications that are prescribed are oxycodone or OxyContin type medications, morphine, and they come in different formulations. Fentanyl, they come in patches that you can place on the skin, or they can be in a sucker. We use hydromorphone, we use hydrocodone, and the common hydrocodone formulations are Vicodin or Lortab. And now, increasingly, we have drugs that are formulated with buprenorphine. So those are the most common that we prescribe.
Dr. Webster lectures internationally on the subject of preventing opioid abuse and criminal diversion in chronic pain patients. He is certified in addiction medicine and anesthesiology and has recently authored a book called Avoiding Opioid Abuse While Managing Pain.
I see a lot of people with substance abuse, and some of these people have evolved out of the treatment of pain with these hard medications, these very powerful medications like OxyContin. And yet, it's also saved, I believe, saved many people's lives.
He is now championing an effort to educate physicians, patients, and communities about the epidemic of prescription drug abuse and is leading a nationwide effort on how to administer them more safely.
This is a healthcare issue. We need to figure out if we in the medical profession should be taking the lead in solving the problem. I think that we have that responsibility. We have kids who are using it for recreational purposes, some of whom end up dying, and we have pain patients who are dying from overuse of the medication and sometimes being prescribed medications that can be harmful. So I saw a huge challenge and learned from the kids how we are contributing to the problem as well.
Dr. Scott Putman shares Dr. Webster's compassion for his patients in pain. He too struggles with finding that right balance of easing their pain and preventing the patient from becoming addicted to the medication. He tells a story of an 18-year-old young adult who was in a serious car accident and crushes his pelvis.
I was involved in reconstructing his urethra. He had several operations, orthopedic operations, operations for his gastrointestinal tract and for his urinary tract. And so he suffered from chronic pain. He required the use of a lot of pain medicine. And in fact, he was seeing a chronic pain doctor. I had given him pain medicines, as had his orthopedic surgeon and GI surgeon. And after we'd given him collectively quite a few, I walked into work one day, and one of the people that works in my office said, "Oh, have you seen the news about your patient?" I said, "No," and they got on the computer and got last night's news on the internet, and I had the sad experience of watching the patient I'd worked so hard on being arrested along with his mother and led into a police car. As it turns out, they were selling OxyContin. And they found in a safe in their house, found OxyContin, a lot of cash, and apparently they were selling it to a high school where they lived.
It's probably one of the easiest things to do is to scam a doctor who wants to help patients. You always believe your patient. The patients come in and they say, you know, I've been hurting and I need this amount of medicine. And they learn how to not ask for a particular drug because that's a red flag. But they just come in and say, you know, I really hurt and ibuprofen's not been working, Tylenol's not been working. You know, I mean, they know how to stage it. They know how to set you up. And so the doctor says, well, okay, just try this a little bit and this hydrocodone or Lortab or Vicodin or OxyContin or something like that. And they win. They use some of it, they sell some of it, they go to parties, and there are the farming parties, which everyone's heard about, where a lot of medicines get thrown into a little pot, and they just pick and choose what they want and chase it with alcohol, and unfortunately sometimes die.
Ethan is now deep into the cycle of his addiction, a poly drug user mixing an array of narcotics for parties.
And there was this party. This was the defining night. I remember this more than anything. I think I OD'd. Like, I had been up for like 2 days. I had started drinking in the morning, smoking all day. We went to a rave, came back, smoked some crack, and then we were doing OC, and I passed out. I wake up the next morning, and I feel horrible. Literally horrible. I've never felt so bad in my life. I get up and I start walking home, and like, I'm in pain, serious physical pain. I can barely walk. it's weird, but I started thinking about my brother. And I'm like, is this really what he would want me to be doing after his death? This isn't healthy for me.
The use of OC, short for OxyContin, increased during the last 5 years among 15-year-olds. 1 in 20 high school seniors reported having abused OxyContin, according to the 2009 National Institute of Drug Abuse.
The prescription pain medicine abuse or non-medical use of prescription pain medicine is really on the rise. Emergency room visits for non-medical use of pain medications have gone from 2 to 10% in 10 years, 111% increase in 10 years. So this is an alarming trend for sure.
How do you know how much to administer and what regulates that for you? What do you decide?
And that's the hardest thing, and I think that gets to the root of the problem. You're not sure. There is no really scientific way of gauging someone's pain. I mean, there is a scale that they use. It's a 0 to 10 scale, 10 being the worst pain you've ever felt in your life and 0 being no pain at all. That's the only validated scale there is for assessing someone's pain, but it's still very general. So, of course, what you want to do is err on the side of over-treating their pain, because you have a duty when someone sees you in their office to relieve their suffering. So you often end up giving fairly strong pain medications, especially for these stone patients.
Urologist Dr. Scott Putman treats a lot of patients with kidney stones who are in a lot of pain.
And the real problem is you don't know to whom you're giving these medications. Is this someone who, yeah, we have CT scans and we have our, the history and the physical exam that we use, plus the imaging and lab values that we use to make a determination about how the patient's doing and what kind of distress they're in. When it comes down to in the very end is it's very subjective. The same stone that's very small and may cause no pain in one person may cause a tremendous amount of pain in the other person. And you just, in the final analysis, you really can't know who is who.
Some patients become tolerant, meaning they need increased amounts of the pain medications to maintain the same level of relief. After about 3 to 4 months, patients reach a plateau where you don't need to continuously increase the dose. People who are wanting to increase the dose are either seeking more pain relief than is possible from pain medications, or they are seeking a different emotional effect.
There are certain things that they do, and that is try to act like they're prescription narcotic virgins. The general problem is not funny. However, some of the methods that are used are kind of humorous. The stumbling over the names is one of the funniest because it's almost universal. They will say, I had something in the past and I just can't, it's purpose something. Because what they're doing is fishing to get Percocet instead of Lortab, which is much stronger. And so the idea is that, I'm so innocent of this stuff, I hardly even know what it's called. But that's something that we kind of laugh at because we see it all the time.
Dr. Putman is realizing that he can't depend on the stereotype of an addict when prescribing pain medications to his patients.
While I was still in medical school, you always have this idea of who, the drug seeker is. You kind of think of this real obvious-looking junkie that's shivering and itchy and skinny and really being up front and saying stuff like, come on, you got to help me, man. You got to help me. It really isn't. You see all kinds of people. And I was awakened to this problem early in my practice when I treated a young man for an obstructed stone, and he required a lot of pain medicines. And certainly, again, it's hard to gauge who needs how much pain medicine. He was a nice guy. I'd met his whole family. He had a wife and 3 kids, and just your typical Utah family, really nice guy. Turns out he had stolen my prescription pad and had been writing prescriptions in my name for OxyContin and oxycodone, up to 200 at a time, all up and down the Intermountain Corridor from northern Idaho down to Arizona. So, and it was a side business of his. So, and this was a guy, if he asked you for pain medicine, you would give it to him because he was such an honest guy. so easy to get a volume of narcotic pain medications that it's become a market. Now, people are always going to be able to get some prescription narcotic pain medicines to abuse, but just not getting it easily. And the funny thing is when they've been seen at one of the emergency rooms in Intermountain, and I'm able to look and see exactly how much they were prescribed, you know, they say, well, I think I got 5 pills. And I said, really, it says here you got 30. Oh, yeah, you know what? It was 30. You're right. And I do have enough. So it does help if there's some kind of system for tracking. And we do have a system that tracks it, but that system needs to be nationwide.
We are being scammed, so we're now aware that this has become a social problem in our country.
The abuse of prescription drugs is a serious problem in Utah. The 2007 film Happy Valley by Ron Williams illuminates the epidemic of prescription drug abuse in the state. This true story from the film takes place in Ogden, northern Utah. Mrs. Ballingham talks about her son Blake, who went from a popular leader with good grades and on sports teams to a recluse who would come home and go right to sleep.
Blake would be high or would have drugs on him. My youngest daughter, who was in junior high, would come home and go straight upstairs. My other son was serving a mission, so he was kind of out of the loop anyway. And we all knew that eventually he was going to overdose doing what he'd done. We knew that he couldn't do what he was doing and live through it. And I was upstairs getting ready to go to work, and my husband came running upstairs and screaming at me, saying, Suzanne, come down. Something's wrong with Blake. And he was laying on the bed, and my first thought was that he had cotton in his nose because he had foam coming out of his nose and his mouth. And then I realized that it was mucus and that he most likely had a seizure. I pulled him off the bed and couldn't get his mouth open because I think he was still having a seizure. And I remember thinking as I was prying his mouth open that he was going to bite my finger off, but you don't care, you know. And I got his mouth open and started doing CPR on him.
They rushed him to the emergency room.
It was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life, to sit there and look at my son who had a gazillion tubes going into him. You know, at that point he wasn't a person, he was just somebody that they were trying to save. And I remember thinking that it's almost okay that he'll be better off, that he's been through so much hell in the last 2 years, that maybe this is a better thing for him. The physician told us at that point that he would die, that we would be taking him off the ventilator later on that afternoon. So to get our family together and to get everybody there to say their last, you know, say their goodbyes to Blake. And it was horrible. I mean, I remember standing against the wall, sliding down and sobbing, and my daughter was sobbing, and my other daughter was, and my husband, and grandmas and grandpas and friends. I mean, all the friends from Bonneville High, they had to call security to clear the halls because there were so many kids that were standing there crying.
Even though Mrs. Ballingham saw the signs, she did not understand the gravity nor how to address it. University of Utah child psychiatrist Dr. Melissa Lopez-Larson talks about the warning signs of a teenager abusing drugs.
When kids start and adolescents start giving up friends, and when they start giving up activities, you know, when their whole life or most of their life or many, many hours of the day is spent trying to figure out how they're going to get the marijuana or how they're going to get anything else, is usually the signs that there's something going on. Also, kids tend to have more behavioral problems. They tend to get more anxious or irritable or angry or just not themselves. And I know that's often very difficult for parents to try to figure out, because adolescence is often a period of great turmoil sometimes, with a lot of stress and a lot of, you know, changes in mood and things of that nature. But usually kids that are using, they tend to go above and beyond the typical normal distress of adolescence.
And I just decided that's not my life. I mean, you only get one life, and it's not the life I wanted to live.
Blake beat the odds and survived the overdose.
The drug problem has gone through the terrace in Ogden like a disease, wiping friends out and my buddies out one by one. I mean, it's overwhelming. My perspective on it was, I mean, it's only a pill. My whole sophomore year, I don't think I experimented with anything more than Lortab or Percocet. And my junior year is when I started to bump it up a little bit. I would start, doing OxyContin, morphine suckers, and my senior year it got out of control. I was all over the place looking for it, doing two or three, four or five pills a day. Spending hundreds of dollars a day doing it. I would look at heroin as in a whole different game than OxyContin. I've never even seen heroin for the fact that just the name heroin, but it's in the same ballpark. It kills people just the same way heroin does. OxyContin is actually a synthetic-based heroin. It's heroin into a pill.
That was a clip from the Utah documentary film Happy Valley by Ron Williams. Blake was lucky and made it into recovery. And that is where Dr. Lynn Webster feels our health system has a gap. Post-treatment is a less emphasized part of rehab, but necessary to prevent drug addicts from recidivism. And for vulnerable teenagers, it is even more important to catch their addictions early on, when their brains are still developing and their futures are on the line.
Most people who've not been in this area see these kids and individuals who have substance abuse problems as less than good people. And that is so far from the truth, it infuriates me. These are human beings. These are good human beings that have just made some bad choices. And because of their genetics and because of the environment and or environment, they get into trouble. Just like a lot of us get into trouble, particularly if we overeat and we have diabetes or heart disease. It's a medical condition that they have a problem with. And when they get into a school that is removed, they seem to be successful.
Former teen addict Ethan lives by his new creed.
These are synthetic feelings. This is just a realization I've had over the past couple of weeks, It feels so much better to work hard and not be on drugs. And the feeling you get from actually accomplishing something is such a big high, better than, any drug could ever give you. And that's amazing to me.
That was part two of our series, Adolescent Recovery. It takes a community. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
And if I die before I wake, I hope the Lord won't hesitate to pluck my coffin from the ground.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. Get ready for an evening of new bluegrass music this week as I feature the world-class instrumentalists Brad and Ken Kolodner and the new album from Steve Spurgeon. I'll also play songs from new releases by Lori Lewis, Barefoot, and Jack Straw, among other talented artists. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.